Okay, this is Samantha Garlock with La Crista Greco for part three of our interview.
Hello.
Okay, it looks
is like... Is the volume okay?
Looks like the volume's okay.
Good.
Okay, so last time we talked about you working at UW.
Mm-hmm.
You are also a grad student.
Yes.
What program are you in and when did you start?
So I'm in the iSchool program, what it's called now, was called SLIS, School of Library and Information Science. I believe they changed the name last year to iSchool. Anyways, I started in that program, to think for a second, September 2017. And I am in my last semester now and here, spring semester 2020. So it will have taken me about 3 years 'cause I have been doing the program part-time since I work full-time. But yeah, I should finish this May. So that's exciting. Yeah. Thank you.
So what led to your decision to start at this program?
Yeah, so I had been working for the university for about, let's see, in 2017, 3 years probably, in the Office of the Gender and Women's Studies Librarian. And I had always been somewhat interested in librarianship. I think many people are. But I never really had worked in a library before my job here, and I never totally knew what librarians did, which again, I think is like a lot of people. And so since my supervisor, Carla Strand, is a librarian here, working closely with her really sort of let me see more of that world. And then, of course, just working in a library. But yeah, it was really kind of... she always jokes that she, like, converted me to it, you know, because not like I was ever resistant to it, but it just never was really, like, I never really thought, oh, yeah, I'm going to get another master's and do it in this specifically. So it was kind of a surprise that I wanted to do it and that I was going to go back to school after being out for 10 years, so... but yeah, I would say it was sort of a combination of people and things that made me decide to go for that.
So
I did, yeah.
And have you been in the online program for all 3 years?
Right. So I'm in the online program, which has been really great since I work full time, and it would just be, I think, too difficult to try to go to classes, even if they're in the evenings. It just would have been a lot. So being in the online program has been really great for all of those reasons, yeah.
So you mentioned that you never really knew what a librarian did.
Yeah.
So what does a librarian do now that you're almost done with program?
Well, I mean, first there's just so many different types of librarianship and, you know, different just spaces that librarians can go into and even create their own space. And so, you know, I think a lot of librarians hear from people outside of the library world, like, oh, all you do is read books all day, like wish that was a job, right? But like maybe if you're a book reviewer or something, it probably is your job, but that's not what a librarian does. I still don't know. I can't say exactly what all like a public librarian does or some other sort of other kinds of librarians, but academic librarians are, you know, subject liaisons and work a lot with faculty, students, of course. In our office, we work with people, community members as well. So really anybody who, you know, comes through our door or calls us or emails us. I know my supervisor works a lot via email with people on reference questions and things like that. and there's a lot of tech stuff too involved that I think a lot of people don't know about, or there it's, you know, a lot more data heavy and tech heavy than I think it was, you know, a decade ago or so. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll just continue to move in that direction. I think also with the rise of digital libraries and things like that, there's sort of, you know, different things happening with that world. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think every librarian does, you know, maybe a few similar things, but I think they all kind of do something different as well, mm-hmm. depending on what type of librarian they are, or, you know, their personality, of course, too. So that's what I think is something that is really exciting to me about it, about the profession, is that you can kind of, to some extent, make it what you want it to be in some ways. And so that feels really exciting and liberating. And so.
Cool. So you mentioned academic librarianship. Is that the track that you're on?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. I feel, I was just thinking about this the other day. Throughout my coursework in this program, I've really kind of gone all over the place. So I don't really have a specialty. If I have a specialty, I'd say it was probably more around like digital curation, digital libraries, mainly because it's something I'm really interested in, that stuff. But the only sort of downside with the online program is that we're not able to take any in-person classes, even if we live here. They really separate it. And I understand it for probably bureaucratic reasons. They have to because of the university says, et cetera. But it's a shame because there are classes that I would have loved to take that they weren't open to me taking because I was an online student. And so, and they haven't figured out how they could teach those virtually, I guess, yet, which I wish they would. Specifically, a lot of the archive classes, which I'm also really interested in, but haven't been able to take as many classes in that as I would have liked to. But so I would say, yeah, academic librarianship, that track kind of, as well as some data stuff, but not to the extent that some people. I am really interested in archives and that work as well. So, kind of a little bit of everything, but leaning more towards those things, I would say.
Tell me about some of the like tech and data stuff that you've learned, because it is all like changing so fast.
Like what that'll be like in another 10, 20 years. So I did a practicum. We have to do a practicum in the program. You can do up to as many as you want, I think. You have to at least do one. But so I did one, a remote practicum for this software company called Rabble, who created this this music cataloging software called Musicat, and it's used in Madison Public Library. It's used in some, mostly public libraries use it. I think they're trying to get some partnerships with academic libraries, but it just presents a different sort of host of issues with that. But anyways, I interned with them and dealt a lot with their data from their, like the musicians that had their stuff on the public library websites. And so I was tasked with creating a data collection and data retention policy or plan. It wasn't totally a policy because it wasn't super formal, and it couldn't really be a mandated thing because it had kind of, you know, each library kind of has their own governance and they have to depend on, especially if they're a public library, they have to depend on the state, et cetera. So it was really interesting, though, for me, because I had never really done that kind of work on, like, data retention and collection. And this was specifically about personally identifiable information, or PII. So things like, and we were specifically looking at things like ethnicity and gender, and, you know, questioning, like, should we collect this type of data? Why, you know, do we have good reasons that we're collecting it, or that the libraries were collecting it, rather? What are the potential problems with that? What are the issues with that? And so it was really my job to sort of research all of that, which I did, and then create this kind of plan, or just, you know, a document of sort of best practices that libraries could function with. And so what I found was that everybody I talked to, like data librarians and people in tech, were like, do not collect this type of data, like, whatsoever. My advisor, Dorothea Salo, who I love, was like horrified when I told her about what they were collecting, because she was just like, this presents way more issues than any good that it could potentially do. So I brought all this back to my supervisor at the practicum, and we then talked to the libraries and sort of surveyed them to ask, like, why are you using this, or like, why do you feel like you need it? And they did have some good reasonings for using the data. I mean, for them, it was about trying to create inclusive collections and diversity in their collections. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of using that specific data for that, and it was open text fields, so it wasn't like, and everything I found with researching this was like, if you're gonna ask for that, make sure it's open text so that people don't feel like, oh, well, my identity is not up here, like, or if you just offer, like, you know, male or female, or like, mm-hmm. that's problematic, or...
So open text would be a box where you
just an empty box and you can type in whatever.
As opposed to multiple choice.
Right. So people could just, type in whatever, however they identified. And it wasn't a required thing either. Mm-hmm. So if the person didn't feel comfortable doing that, they didn't have to. That kind of data collection, then a data analysis can be a bit tricky because it is open text, but you know, we've had some public librarians who found ways to deal with that and are fine to deal with that. But so my personal recommendation was to just not collect it and use other ways to sort of make sure you're getting inclusivity and diversity, like, you know, outreach and going into communities, marginalized communities that maybe are not showing in your collections. And some were doing that anyways. But I think my supervisor wanted to also make sure the librarians kind of were heard. And she thought it would be better if we kind of had these like best practices. So like let them continue to do what they were doing if they wanted to. But to make sure that it's sort of implemented in this way and, you know, open text and all that kind of stuff. And then to also have these other measures that you're using as well. So you're not just relying on that as your sole, you know, source of, figuring out if a collection is diverse or whatever. So that's a long, long little story about that. But, so that was really interesting. And then deciding on how long to retain that data. I mean, really, you shouldn't retain it at all. But certainly, you know, do what you need to do with the data and then, you know, delete it immediately as soon as you can. So that was kind of the retention part of it that we decided on. So.
And so how were they collecting the data? Was it like when people signed up for library cards, or was it just a survey?
So it was for specifically the musicians who would want to enter their music up on the MusicCat site, which each of these 11 or so partner libraries have these sites now. And so it was coming from the bands that would be, you know, usually they're local to whichever library they're trying to get up on. There's a whole jury selection process, so it's not like you fill something out and right away you get online. Mm-hmm. There's a group of people that are supposed to be a diverse group of people who all kind of come together and talk about it. So it was for that information. It was only for information on the back end that like the librarians would see. Mm-hmm. It wasn't public. They do have the opportunity, the artists do have the opportunity to have like a bio and stuff. So I guess some of them would, if it was mm-hmm. important to them, would sort of state some of their identities in that space. So that was another way that the librarians could also, you know, glean from it, like if their collections were diverse or whatnot. But yeah, it was mostly just from the musicians then. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know if the bios were like searchable? So like if someone was like, I only want to listen to queer musicians.
Yeah. I think so. Because Rabble builds these sites essentially mm-hmm. with the software. The website then is linked to from the public library page. It's its own thing though. And so I think that's how the search function works with that, but I'm not totally sure. That's a good question.
I was just curious.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think that's what they did, though. Yeah.
That sounds like a really interesting project.
Yeah, it was. I just presented at ALA Midwinter last week So it went really well.
What is ALA Midwinter?
American Library Association, their Midwinter Conference. Mm-hmm. So it's not the big ALA conference, but it's their sort of one that's held every January, late January. So this time it was in Philadelphia. And yeah, I presented with my previous supervisor of that project, Kelly Heiser, and one of the partner librarians, Kate Sellers from Seattle Public Library. So yeah, it was a good time. I think it went well. I don't know. We got good discussion and feedback from people. So yeah. Yeah.
Have you done any other presentations like that, like at conferences?
That was my first library conference, so it was kind of, a big deal. I have presented at previous women's studies conferences, haven't in quite a while, though. Typically, I've just present on guerrilla feminism stuff, so mm-hmm. I haven't really presented on others. This was, kind of first-time library stuff conference, so... Yeah.
And how was that different from women's studies conferences that you've been to? And how was it different presenting on like this like library project versus guerrilla feminism?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I've only really been to a couple different women's studies conferences, but they're much more chill, I feel like, than a library conference. I think this was really my first time at a library conference, but there were a lot more white men, so that was interesting to be in a space where that was a thing. Like a lot of spaces, but since I'm used to going to women's studies conferences, it's very different in that regard. In terms of like the difference between speaking about this stuff and speaking on GF stuff, that's also very different. I think that the GF stuff is easier for me to talk about in some ways, because it's really just my own sort of story with that. This, it's more like there is kind of a right and wrong answer in some ways. And I also feel the pull to have to sort of be more academic and whatever that means, right? So try to not swear as much when I'm presenting, which I do very freely most of the time and in my GF presentations. But this, it's like, you know, I do feel I have to kind of hold some stuff in a little bit more, although I also kind of go against that because I also don't really care. So yeah, I think I was way more nervous for this presentation because of that, and also because I was co-presenting with two other people, something I hadn't done before. So I typically have just presented by myself. So it's just different to be, you know, co-presenting with others and getting timing and all of that stuff right. But it was a good experience, though.
Great.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a really interesting project. Have you worked on, have there been any other projects that have been part of your schoolwork, mm-hmm. or other things related to classes and the program that have been interesting?
I mean, I took one class on genealogy and did some fun like family history projects, which I know I had mentioned in one of the earlier interviews we did. So that was, I mean, that sticks out in my mind because that was just like really fun and didn't feel like work or school mm-hmm. to me. And so I think back to that quite a bit because it's doing that project and even just like, you know, we had sort of these reference questions related to genealogy that the professor like posed to us. Those were fun too, you know, to try to like find the correct, like John Smith or whatever, you know, with this birth date and this death date or whatever. And so that class and the projects we did in that class were really fun and great. I really liked the content of my digital curation class and digital collections class. I liked learning more about that. I wouldn't necessarily say the class was that great, but I liked the content for the most part and learning more about just like the background of all of that stuff because I'm interested in it.
Tell me more about the content of the class.
Just like learning about just all the stages that go into curating a digital collection or figuring out how to, like, which platform to use for this or, you know, like a content DM platform or Omeka, or these are different platforms that digital collections people can use. Just that kind of stuff because I didn't have much knowledge, not much foundational knowledge. I kind of had a very broad overview of, like, what it maybe was, but not sort of, like, this is what you do and these are the steps, etc. So that was helpful and I liked that. I'm trying to think what other classes. I don't know.
That's okay.
Those two stand out kind of the most right now anyways.
So tell me more about like what exactly is a digital collection?
Mm-hmm.
Because like you have like physical collections where you go and like look at the materials and like mm-hmm. hold them with your hands.
Right.
And then there are like digitized
yeah.
things. And
right.
then there are catalogs where you like can sort of see like information about things, but you still sort of have to go look at the physical item.
Right, yeah.
So what is a digital collection? How does it fit in to like
the bigger
yeah.
scheme of things. I mean, so I don't know if this is going to be a right or wrong response, so you can correct me because you're also a library student. I mean, I think about like what UW Digital Collections does. They primarily, you know, digitize, whether that means like scanning items or taking photos. They have a photo studio in their office. Taking photos of bigger items, things like that, and then cataloging them, putting them, you know, creating metadata for them, putting them up on their site, usually specifically in a certain category, right? And so there's some collections, I believe, that are up there were donated, some were, you know, things that the UW had. I remember our office, so we were gifted, it's called the Dovey Horowitz or Horowitz collection, and there's a lot of different like women's and like feminism stuff that is happening in that collection. There's a really cool like Joan of Arc, like vintage Joan of Arc poster that was part of that collection. And so I remember when I started in working here, a library student that was working in our office actually was also working on that collection and helping to digitize those items, so that people could then go to UW Digital Collections website and, you know, look through them, search for various things they wanted to search for. I know there's audio recordings, video. There's a lot of different things, anything that can be digitized really, in some way. So I don't know if that's a good response.
I mean, that's...
Do you concur with that?
Yes,
that's okay,
I concur.
Good. Okay, good.
So for you, do you think digital collections are, or like the idea of having it, is it more, it seems like it's like to give like another avenue of access?
Yeah, for sure.
Do you think it's more to promote access for people who are like not on campus?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just like another way to look at things that are, so you don't have to like go into the library and like find the specific physical thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it depends, because I know that like some of the physical things a student probably wouldn't be able to get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's because it's like housed somewhere like in special collections, or I know like Historical Society has a lot of stuff that you can't touch and like that whole thing. So I think it's a couple things. I mean, it's like to create more access, but also because of some of the history of some of the items, a patron wouldn't necessarily be able to just like come in and be like, I want to look at this thing from like 1901 or whatever and like feel it and handle it. Like that might not be allowed. So depending on, you know, different things, but, so I think it's a way for people to then see, visually, like from home, or even if they're at the library, but on a computer, or look at it on a tablet or phone, even to sort of be able to engage with it in that way, still engaging with it in some way,
mm-hmm.
Even if they can't engage with it in person. So I do think access. I mean, I think about like DPLA, Digital Public Library of America. They're really trying to promote and create access in, you know, throughout institutions for basically for people who can't go to wherever, you know, this item might be. So, you know, I think it's great in that way too, if you're like somebody who's outside of the US or somebody who's in a different state as this, you know, thing you want to look at, but you can't actually travel there or something. So I think digital collections makes it really accessible in those ways. And that's, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff that you can find, right? So, I think it's kind of a both and, or a mix to some extent. So,
that totally makes sense. And maybe even also, like, if it is something that you could go to the Historical Society and look at, you might not be able to, like, take it back to your dorm with you.
Right, yeah, yeah, that's totally true, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And with the genealogy class, mm-hmm. I know we talked a bit about your own family history research. What kind of things did you learn in the genealogy class that you like hadn't already mm-hmm. figured out, either like tools to use or like things that you then found out about your family?
I mean, I hadn't heard of the site familysearch.com, which I know is like created mostly by and for Mormons. So like, you know, props to them. But I hadn't heard of that website, I really had only heard of Ancestry because it's everywhere, for better or for worse. So that was exciting because it's a, FamilySearch is completely free. That was cool because I had, a lot of times in my personal searches before I took that class, it's like I would just keep hitting paywalls of things and like, I don't want to pay for, it's like, I don't really have the money and blah, blah, blah. So learning about that was really cool. I think just learning too about more about what genealogists do and the work that they do, and that there's usually one in, most public libraries at least, and they're there to help with that is really cool. And I think something that maybe a lot of people don't know about. They do a lot of great work. Learning about, I forgot what the actual name of it is, but the actual Genealogy Society of America or whatever that their big sort of governance is, learning their sort of like their ethics and their code of conduct, and that was interesting just to see like what it is that they, the sort of rules that they, decide to abide by and what are part of that profession. Just because I don't know why I'm interested in that stuff. It's just interesting to kind of look at. It's kind of looking at a profession's sort of code of ethics or code of conduct, I think, is like a good way to figure out sort of some job duties in the in the profession to some extent. And so I kind of like looking at those for those reasons, just to see like, okay, so they do that and they don't do this and they,
What were some things that stood out to you on that list?
I think the biggest one, which, I think is pretty obvious, but it's the fact that they, it's really important to have the correct dates for things and for people that they're looking up, and that they will, tell you the truth about what they're finding. And there's just this these elements of honesty and like, facts. So, which, in this day and age, it's wild to think that a lot of people don't care for facts, but I think just like that, it's really obvious stuff, but it's really important, especially to genealogy. And you can't really do a lot if you don't have dates and like, the right spelling, although sometimes you can kind of figure things out. But I think the attention to detail is just really incredible too. Like there is just a lot that you have to, make sure that you have that's correct. And and as somebody who, like myself, who really likes that kind of stuff, I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. Like I could imagine doing that kind of a job or something, and it's also, I think the thing I like about it too is just that it's, you kind of feel like you're solving a puzzle with it, with that work. It's very much like, okay, so like this person, came here, they left here, and where did they go from here though, between these years? And it very much is, you're sort of a detective and trying to kind of solve this mystery or something. So I don't know, that I think that's also something that I was really like, this is fun.
Like,
even if I'm not like looking at my own family, this is still like fun. Mm-hmm. Like I would do this for somebody else, mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's kind of, I think, what I liked about that, and what I learned. And
sounds really fun.
Yeah, it was a good class. Vicky Tobias taught it, and she's really great, so, yeah.
Have you considered trying to become, like, a genealogy librarian or genealogist?
I haven't really, that's a good question. I haven't really looked into it. I should, though, because I kind of forgot about the class after I took the class maybe my second year. Mm-hmm. So it's been a while. But now that we're talking about it again, I'm like, oh my God, wait. Like, so I should look at that. I don't know what that specific sort of niche of librarianship is really like in terms of jobs and all of that. But yeah, that would be a good thing to look into, I think. Because yeah, it's definitely something that I like and have fun with, so...
Yeah, because I was going to ask, other than working at the Office of the Gender and Women's mm-hmm. Studies Librarian, like, what kind of library might you want to work in, or what kind of librarian might you want to try to be?
I don't know. I mean, I think academic librarianship is where I think, I mean, I have the most experience, clearly, but I also enjoy that work. I'm not against public librarianship, working in a public library. I've just never done it, so I don't know what all that would entail or be like. I'd be open to it. I'm interested in digital librarianship, whatever that looks like. I just think that would be cool. I feel like I kind of do some of that with some of the GF stuff that I do already, so, you know, just sort of like answering reference questions online mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. So I don't know, maybe creating my own path in that would be cool if I could, I don't know. Other than that, I mean, I probably wouldn't go too tech heavy. I'm interested in tech and like data librarianship, but I also just feel like I don't have the brain for that exactly. Mm-hmm. Like I, not to the extent that like some people who mm-hmm. are super into it, like, or can just really think about numbers and things in that way. I can't totally do that. And so, I'm interested in that work, but probably not to the extent where I would want like some data librarian position. I don't know that I would really excel at that. So
what aspects of that work are interesting to you?
I mean, I took a class on data visualization, and like that was really cool, and like being able to use different tools. I'm blanking on what the platform we used was. But being able to, you know, put your data into something and then choosing sort of a visualization for it, whether it be like a bar graph or like something, you know, but like different colors. Like some people's data visualizations can just look really beautiful. And like that's something that before I took that class, I was like, what? Like, what is this? You know? And I would never, it's almost kind of mixing design and art with data, and data and science almost. And so I really kind of like how that kind of weaves together. So I think that's, I mean, and I like thinking about data. I just feel like I can't do it that well. So, because yeah, it's just hard sometimes, you know, it's difficult work. Yeah. And if you're not, like, I feel like if you're not really like sort of math oriented or science oriented, mm-hmm. it's just harder, at least for mm-hmm. me, that's why it's harder. So, yeah. But yeah, so that's probably, yeah, why.
Yeah. The data visualization sounds really interesting though. Tell me more about like that class and like mm-hmm. what the process was, because I am also not super like a data person.
So it was only a 1-credit class, mm-hmm. so it was like entirely too fast, but I mean I knew that going into it, that it was gonna feel like pretty fast. So I kind of wish I had more time with it, but we were like, I think our main project in that class was to find some data. And there's a lot of different open data sources. Mm-hmm. I can't really think of any examples right now, but I know that there are, because that's how we were able to find mm-hmm. data. I specifically looked at data regarding women in prison. And then I specifically from there looked at like marginalized women in prison. And I think I compared like three races. I think I compared white women in prison, black women in prison, and I think indigenous and native women in prison in the US. So that was sort of where I started. And then just created this colorful kind of, I mean, it was pretty simple bar graph, but it was like prettier than most of the bar graphs I had created before the class. So to just sort of show the disparity of like, I'm pretty sure it was indigenous women were the most imprisoned, followed by black women and then white women. To show that disparity. So that was pretty striking then at the end to see that. And then we just had to sort of create like a report on that, like on our findings or sort of to demonstrate what the data was saying and why we decided to show it in this specific way. So that was pretty much it. It was like, you know, a 5-week class. So it was like real quick, mm-hmm. but that was the, like the main thing that we did in that class. That
sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. It was my first time like doing anything mm-hmm. with data visualization. So yeah.
Are there any other classes that, where you learned something that was like exciting to learn mm-hmm. or any classes that you really didn't like? You can also talk about that.
I mean, I didn't like methods. What is okay. that, 603, I think? Mm-hmm. Or yeah. I mean, I didn't really like any of the first three, like mm-hmm. 601, 602. So, like, I'm going to be blanking on the names. Maybe you know, but...
I think 603 is, like, research methods
for yeah.
information professionals.
And then 601 is, like, information context or something.
Yeah, something like that. And then...
602... I don't know. They're the first three required yeah. classes, though, in the program. And I get why they're required to some extent, but it's like usually the required classes are kind of not the most fun. So, I mean, I did learn, you know, some interesting things. I think in 602, or no, it was 601, we did an interesting kind of project where we had to, it was a unit on internet and like broadband.
Oh.
And we had to look at a specific population and look at their access basically. So it was looking at access issues, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. So I chose a very rural community in Woodville, Wisconsin, a very small town. Because I thought that would be more interesting to look at than like mm-hmm. something like Madison. Because
right.
I mean, I live here. I already know kind of the access stuff mm-hmm. and like clearly we have fairly good broadband and mm-hmm. whatever. So I looked at Woodville, Wisconsin, and it was interesting because it just kind of, you know, made this point that like, yeah, if you're in a rural community, you have way less access, which I think people know to some extent, but to like see that or to actually read about mm-hmm. it and like then also read about how not having access disrupts so much in the community. Like, you know, if there's not library access, even at the library, they have a library there, but like if the internet's down, mm. then community members, if they don't have, and a lot of the people didn't have internet at their house, so they couldn't like apply to jobs really. They couldn't do a lot of things. And so that I think many of us take for granted if we're in a bigger city with better broadband and, mm-hmm. and internet access. So that was a cool project. And just learning more about, yeah, types of broadband and that. So that was interesting. I'm trying to think what other ones. I liked that I liked having to do a practicum, but I didn't like the course part of it.
Okay.
I think the course part of it was just a lot of busy work and mm-hmm. kind of like I would have preferred to just concentrate on this other practicum. I also think There are a lot of issues with how they create the practicum for online students. Because I had a really hard time. I had to do a remote one. I could not try to do something different. There was just no way. Because I have a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really talked about how that was an issue. And it wasn't really, didn't really seem all that respected by professors that, like, yeah, some people have full-time jobs and they can't just work for free. Also, that's unethical and fucked up. So that was probably, I mean, you know, I really, that really upset me. Luckily, I got a really great placement, but I did that my own. I didn't have help with getting that placement.
And that was the project you were talking about?
Yeah, at Rabble. And basically how I got that is I put this thing out on Twitter, and Kelly, who is was the CEO at the time of Rabble, contacted me. And
awesome.
I mean, she knows, she's like, she went to, she got her PhD here, so she has some, you know, relationship to the university and stuff. But, like, I mean, the, my professor didn't help me get that. Nobody at the iSchool helped me do that. They give you a list of placements, but they're all, like, physical placements, and I, that was just not going to be, I would have loved to be able to go, like, work in special collections or, like, archives or something, but it's just not feasible with a full-time job.
I think that's something they would take into account for...
You'd think so, for online students. I mean, that's a piece of feedback I'm planning to give them at the end, too, is it's just, like, this could be done in a lot of better, different ways. Because, yeah, I would have liked to get other experience, but, you know, it's like the only places open on weekends are public libraries, but those are the places that get the most people, like, want to, or at least in my cohort, a lot of people wanted to do public librarianship, and so those got pretty taken up pretty quickly, and I wasn't really wanting to do public librarianship, though, anyway, so I didn't really want to do a practicum there, and so I just had, like, weeknights after 5 p.m., which is, like, not a lot of time. So I really had to do a remote practicum and was just not given a lot of support with finding that or, you know, adjusting anything. So that was unfortunate. And I think just the practicum course itself is a lot of busy work. And it's like, we don't really need to be doing that when we're working. Like, you know, I just think that's, I mean, you know, maybe like a couple reflections or something here or there, sure. But weekly assignments, I just think that's, I mean, that's really kind of undergrad level stuff to like check that you're doing something. I just think that's ridiculous. So I wasn't super happy with that, but it worked out, thankfully, for me. I'm trying to think what other classes I took. I don't know. I'm currently in a one credit e-portfolio and job search class, which also has a lot of busy work, but I do appreciate that, like, the subject matter so far has been really helpful and practical, and so that's been good. Because I feel like, you know, I, like, it of course helps to have somebody else look at my resume or, like, you know. So I like that it's, there's a lot of very practical things happening with that. And then I'm also taking a management course, which is one of the required classes, which seems fine. And then I'm taking a course on university and college libraries, which also seems fine, although the workload seems a little ridiculous, but but,
like,
you know,
a little too much or...
Yeah, it kind of feels like anytime there's an adjunct teaching a class in this program, they are trying way too hard and have a, they just put a ton more shit out at you than, like, one of the regular professors, which is kind of interesting. So I don't know, I mean, I'm sure they probably feel some level of, like, push from, you know, the program or professors to, like, do it that way. But it's just kind of like, okay, this is kind of too much, but okay. So, yeah, we'll see how those turn out.
So when you were making the decision to start the program, was it, did you ever think about applying to any other online programs at other schools, or were you sure that if you were going to do it, it would be UW-Madison, or?
I just applied here because of tuition, basically, in-state tuition. That was primarily my reasoning, and also because I knew I could potentially ask my employer for tuition money, and I couldn't probably, they wouldn't cover it if it was probably outside of state. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it just was easier to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And I knew UW had a, you know, obviously has a good reputation, mm-hmm. and their iSchool has a good reputation. And I met with, you know, some of the professors before I applied. And so I could talk with them and get more information. And so, and I clearly wasn't looking to move or anything at this point. So it just was, yeah, it made sense to do it here. So I didn't apply elsewhere. Yeah, just here.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah. Why bother if you know that's like the, you know, so. Yeah.
Who have been some professors who have been like really good online?
Vicky Tobias. Mm-hmm. She's great. Michelle Bazant, when she was here. She's retired now. Oh, gosh. Who else have I had? Like, I wish I could remember names easier. I mean, Dorothea Salo, my advisor. I had one class with her, linked data. The class was difficult for me, but she is just a really great professor and very, very funny, first of all, but also just very helpful and, you know, makes everything lighter and not so intense, which I appreciate, especially if it's something like linked data, which I still don't totally know what the hell it is. You know, it's like, it just like the, if the subject matter is really complex, like she's able to kind of find ways to talk about that in a way that most people can understand.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, she's great. I did have some really good adjuncts too. I don't remember their names, but you know, I appreciate the work that adjuncts do, 'cause I know that it's a thankless job. Yeah. So I think those, did I name three? I think those three were probably my top people so far.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah.
Tell me about like your cohort and like what it's been like getting to know people or not getting to know people and like the sense of community or not.
Yeah. My cohort is, I mean, we're all online, right?
Right.
So we have a private Facebook page where we all sort of have interacted and kept in touch. We met at the initial like week-long boot camp thing that the iSchool mandates that you attend in person, even if you're an online student. And so we, you know, I met these people face-to-face, except for one, because she was in Austria, so she could, it was like, there was no way she was going to be able, but I've met her online since. I think the otherwise the furthest person was Alaska, I think. So people from all over, so that was really cool. And then I also met some people who are doing the online program like me, but they're also here in Madison. So we've been in classes together where we've been partnered or grouped on things and been able to kind of work in person together, which was really nice. For me, since this is my second grad program, I was fine with sort of a feeling a lack of community if that happened. I mean, and that's kind of how it is if you're an online student. You do feel kind of disconnected from the specific, you know, school community stuff. But, I mean, I'm 34. Like, that's fine. I don't really care. Like, I had the other experience already in my first grad program and in college, so I didn't feel like I needed to necessarily have that again. But it has been nice being able to, you know, talk to people just on Facebook or email with people and keep in touch that way and talk about classes or, like, you know, ask for help on stuff. And I think we have a really good cohort and everyone's really nice and supportive. So that's awesome. Been good. Yeah. Yeah. So
cool.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned, I don't remember if it was on while we were recording or if it was like before we started at one of these sessions, but you mentioned that you've been involved with the jail library group. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so pretty early on, I think in 2018, maybe January or end of 2017, I started volunteering with the jail library group. Which is a student org, but also a community org. So it kind of is a mix, a hybrid, if you will. There's people who volunteer for it that are not at all related to the university, who just like had heard about it. And then there are, of course, students in the iSchool and students in other programs, I think, too, at the university. And so I started with that, going in with one other person once a month. Is pretty standard for what they want of people. We would go in for like 3 to 4 hours every once a month Saturday.
Go in
to the jail. So the Dane County Jail, there's two. There's the minimum security, and then so the public safety building, and then the city council building. So I would go to the medium to maximum security, the city council building, and go in there. And we would get, there were just, you know, these like half sheets of paper that were basically library requests, book requests. There's a very small library there. People have done a lot of work, in the jail library group to, you know, categorize and organize all of the books. They're all donated. Some of them are in really bad shape. Some are newer, but there's a lot of different stuff. And so sometimes people will request, people who are in the jail will request specific, very specific titles like Harry Potter or something. And sometimes they just will say, like, I want a mystery book or, you know, something like that. And they're allowed up to 3 books at a time. So we would typically give them at least 3 things because they all go through them pretty quickly. And yeah, it was a really interesting experience. My first experience ever inside a jail. So that was intense and interesting. And I then, for a year, was the co-chair with another member in my cohort, Kara Kaufman. I did some more sort of administrative work and less going in at that point. But, it was a really interesting experience to go inside there. And I mean, I think everyone should do that. It's just really, the conditions are very deplorable and the guards are really shitty. Mm-hmm. And it definitely is an experience to just be somewhere where, like, you know that you get to leave, but you know also that these other people don't get to leave. And there are no windows and you can't, you know, it's just, it's very inhumane. And yeah, I think if more people saw that, then maybe things would be done. I don't know, but for the better. But I thought I had limited interaction with the people incarcerated, but did run into some people who would see us in the halls and be like, oh, hey, librarians, and thank us for the work that we did. And it didn't really feel like we were doing all that much, but they were very appreciative of the fact that, like, people cared enough to give them books, you know, and they all really liked getting books each week. So So that was cool to hear and to, like, you know, actually hear that, like, people were glad that we were there and stuff. So it was a really interesting volunteer experience. So I liked it, though. I liked it a lot. So, yeah.
Tell me more about the process. So there was a small library of books in mm-hmm. the jail.
Yes.
Were you also bringing more books?
Sometimes okay. we would have, like, these sort of donation parties, and so mm-hmm. on, like, Sundays or something in the iSchool, and so we would get new, not necessarily new books, but new used books mm-hmm. or from people who would drop them off to us or whatever, because they knew about the organization. And then we would have to stamp them all. They would say Jail Library Group on them. And I believe, because Michelle Bazant was mainly the advisor for, like, most of the time, because it, like, started really with her and, like, some students. Or I think it started when she was a student here. But so she would then have to inform the jail, like, we have some books we want to bring in, can we do this? And we'd have to get permission to do that, of course. And so, and then we would bring them in with us in crates, usually, like, milk crates, and then try to organize them and, you know, by genre is what it was. And yeah, that was basically it. It was pretty, like, bare bones, but, like, it's what we had to work with, so you just kind of had to make do with stuff, and yeah, it worked. So
and did the incarcerated people have access to the library that was in the jail, or is that why they were writing the requests?
Yeah, they weren't allowed in there. Oh. So and it was really more of a closet, like a big closet, than, like, a library or space, what you think of as a library. Mm-hmm. So they weren't allowed in there. Only the guards, and usually the library was locked if no one was in there. When we were in there, the door would be open, and there was a guard station right sort of next to it. But yeah, the people incarcerated weren't allowed in there. So in the minimum security, they have a little different setup. I was only in there a couple times, but they have a even smaller space for their library, but then because they're minimum security, they're allowed to have actual, like, book carts in their pods. Mm. So they can kind of, they still request books, but it's more so, like, changing the cart every week kind of thing. So the librarian there would just kind of, like, take out the books that were there for a week and then replace it with, you know, newer books and bring that whole cart to a specific pod. So they have more privileges, of course, because mm-hmm. they're in minimum security. Mm-hmm. The people in medium and max security weren't allowed anything like that because they're in actual cells. And so we had to, you know, sort of pile their books together and rubber band them and then put them back in these milk crates, and the guards would, like, deliver them to the exact people. So it worked a little different, of course, based on how punitive they wanted to be, unfortunately. But yeah, so it was a little different, just dependent on that. But that was kind of the overall how it worked. Yeah.
That sounds like both rewarding and hard.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, it was my first time, like I said, like doing anything jail volunteer related or jail related, and so. You know, I kind of went in not knowing what to expect. And I mean, I'm glad that I went in with that kind of a mindset, because really it was like on any given day, like sometimes the guards wouldn't let us in because if there was a lockdown for some security reason, or, you know, something happened in the jail, or, you know, so we'd have to just wait. The guards were very verbally abusive, not to us necessarily, but to the people incarcerated. So that was really hard to witness and hear. And just, it smells really bad in there. It just is very shitty. And I'm a total, like, prison abolitionist. And so, like, I mean, I already was against jails and prison, but, like, going into them, I'm like, okay, I'm really against these things now. It's just disgusting how we treat people, regardless of what they've done and whatever. But, so, I mean, I really am glad that I had that experience. And I, again, I, like, really wish everyone could have that kind of experience, because it's just very, I mean, I think it's kind of glorified in, like, media and stuff, and just, like, meh, whatever, like, they get 3 meals a day, like, it's not that bad or something, and it's like, well, just wait until you actually, like, if you ever set foot in a jail or a prison, like, I mean, just the energy of it is so precarious, and, like, you just don't know what's gonna happen, and, you know, it's like, how can any, no wonder, like, people act out there, and, you know, everyone probably feels unsafe to some extent, so, it was a really intense, I think the only other sort of intense volunteer experience I've had similar to that was, like, working for Rape Crisis Center, and that was intense for a different reason, of course, but, you know, just, like, the content, right, is, like, they're both, that's very intense stuff, so the subject matter and stuff, so, but yeah, I, when I saw that that was a, you know, organization here, I was like, oh my God, I had no idea about it, like, I probably would have volunteered if I was just a community member, but had I known about it, so when I started school then here, I, you know, right away I was like, okay, I want to do this. And it was nice to then also meet other people who were in the program that way too. So that worked out really well. Yeah.
And when you were working at the Rape Crisis Center, was that here in Madison or was that when you were in Chicago?
No, that was here. So Dane County Rape Crisis Center. I volunteered there for a year or 2 years maybe, in when I was at Edgewood College, so quite a while ago, but really interesting experience of, like, sleeping overnight there, because I did the night shifts, and so sleeping overnight there on just this, like, fold-out couch, you can't really sleep because you're, you know, anticipating calls coming through, so I would do that, like, once a month or a couple times a month, and that was really interesting and difficult, but good work to be doing. And I mean, I love that organization. I think they do a lot of great work. So, yeah.
So you were answering the helpline?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I did that there and then also at Domestic Abuse Intervention Services DAES. Mm-hmm. So, did helpline at both of those places, taught yoga actually to the women in the shelter at DAES as well for a time. But yeah, the helpline is just really interesting because you just never know what you're going to get and what, you know, how you're going to need to be there for somebody in that moment. And yeah, so.
What's the training like for?
For both of them, it's pretty intensive, which, I mean, I think it has to be. And by intensive, I mean, well, a mix actually of, like, because the content is intense, but also I think they make you do, like, 40 hours of, like, training before you can even get on a call. So I know for days, I know we had, like, a couple weeks of, like, you know, training. So I would go after work and, like, for, like, 3 hours or something. And, like, they would sort of teach us about the organization, but then also about, like, what kinds of calls might come in and, like, how do you respond to somebody depending on what their scenario is. And I'm trying to think what else. But yeah, it was a pretty intensive stuff to be able to like then be on a call and make sure that you're, you know, able to, at the very least, not further harm somebody. Mm-hmm. But, you know, ideally that you're able to help somebody. And I mean, what's nice about both organizations is that they have like an on-call staff always too. So mm-hmm. it's not like you're totally alone. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody really like, if you're like, oh my God, this is like, I don't know what to do. You can always contact the on-call staff person. So that always made me feel a lot better because mm-hmm. just in case, like, or especially at Dane County Rape Crisis Center, if someone had called, I mean, I rarely got calls like this, but if somebody called and they had just gotten raped or something, we would have to call the on-call site person anyways mm-hmm. because, especially if the person wanted someone to accompany them to mm-hmm. get a, you know, exam done at one of the hospitals or something. So, you know, that is what we were supposed to do anyways. Rarely I got calls like that. It was more so from people who were survivors and just like needed help processing or had been triggered by something or, and similarly with at Days, it was kind of a similar thing as people who, not that they were like needing to get out of something in that moment, but it was like they had gotten out and they were like something triggered them or they were scared about something or they just needed help talking through something or processing something. So, and also just people who really just needed to be reminded that of their resilience and that they were okay and that they were safe and that they, you know, can make boundaries for themselves and that's totally and perfectly fine to do. So yeah, it was very rewarding work too. I mean, even though it was intense, it was very rewarding. So.
And you volunteered at the RCC when you were at Edgewood, and when yeah. did you volunteer at Days?
So at Days, it was kind of a mix, I think, because I think I started there. I might have started there when I was also at Edgewood, but then I stopped because I then went to grad school in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But then when I moved back here, I started back up because I actually had known one of my friends at the time had gotten a position there. And so we then created this yoga thing mm-hmm. there. So, and since I was certified in teaching yoga, she just asked me if I wanted to do that. So then I moved from the helpline to teaching yoga to the women in the shelter. It started at their old space off of Monroe Street, but then it continued to their newer space that they're at now. I forgot, Fordham Avenue or something, I think so. So it then went beyond that too, so when they were in their newer space. And that was really, I mean, that was a lot of fun and also very interesting and mm-hmm. difficult.
So when did you get certified teaching yoga?
2010, I believe. So right, like, or wait. Yeah, it was 2010. It was December 2010. I had gotten my first master's degree in June of 2010. Mm-hmm. And then sort of during my AmeriCorps program, I was also then doing yoga teacher training mm-hmm. from Core Power Yoga and in Chicago and got my certificate in that December. So, yep.
I want to come back to that because I don't sure. think we actually talked about
no,
that.
No, I don't think we did either. But
tell me more about the yoga classes that you were doing at Days and what that was like.
Yeah, so it would be in just like a meeting room, a staff boardroom basically. Whoever wanted to come, it was drop-in. So it was somewhat frustrating because sometimes it would just be like nobody and I'd be there and I'd be like, okay, whatever. It was really dependent on the people's mood, whomever was in the house at that point, you know, and whoever really felt like they wanted to. You know, it was primarily Black women who would attend. That's the primary population in the shelter here. And one of the things that I kept hearing from them was like, well, you know, I don't look like they would say for themselves, like we can't do yoga. Like, why, like, we're not, you know, and I would be like, well, why do you think that? And they'd just be like, because like, we're not these skinny white chicks, you know? And so, I was like, God, you know, that's sucks that's the thing that, but you know, that's, yeah, how it is in the media. So, I think a lot of people were just kind of cautious about getting involved with it. For a lot of them, they had never done it before because, I mean, yoga is so expensive. It's like, if you don't, how do you have the money for a drop-in class, which is like $20 or something? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I tried to really make it more about relaxation and more about doing very sort of like simple mostly seated stuff for people and trying to make it accessible for different body types and things like that. And so once I got, you know, some people doing it, they were like, oh, okay, like this is actually kind of nice. Like, we like this, you know? And I had done some trauma-informed yoga training. So, I kind of had known about that. And specifically how useful yoga is for survivors of sexual violence, of domestic violence, for people with PTSD. There's just been a lot of studies about the benefits. With all of that knowledge, I kind of created this program for people. It seemed to be, you know, it did really well. And it was a good time, and yeah. So.
Tell me more about the trauma-informed yoga training.
Yeah, so that's just a specific style of yoga. It's known as a gentle yoga practice. It was designed specifically for, you know, people with PTSD or survivors of some form of violence. And a lot of it is more just really how the instructor sort of verbalizes and goes about the class. So in a traditional yoga class, we're taught to be very commanding and sort of like, do this, do that, like move your foot here, blah, blah, blah. And in a trauma-informed yoga class, it's more, you know, like inviting language. So more, you know, like if it feels good for you, put your foot here or move your foot here, or, you know, if it doesn't feel good, don't do it. Like, go into child's pose whenever you feel like you need to or want to. Honestly, that's kind of how I was already teaching yoga, because I really hated the whole, like, kind of weird U.S. style of yoga of just, like, yelling at people like it was boot camp or something. So I had kind of came to this realization, like, I'm already teaching yoga in this way. So I didn't even, before I knew it was like a very structured thing. So that was, I mean, that was, you know, it just seemed, yeah, very then easy for me to go about teaching that way. Also, trauma-informed yoga, you know, doesn't really want instructors to touch the students at all. Mm-hmm. And so, or if you are going to do adjustments or something, to always get consent in some way. Mm-hmm. And so there have been some places that have created these little like placards or chips even that, mm-hmm. you know, you can hand out to all the students in a class, and they can just put it at the top of their mat, mm-hmm. for, you know, like yes for, you know, adjustments. No, if they don't want it, they can flip it or something. Mm-hmm. So using tools like that, so that it is around empowering the student to really sort of reclaim their body and their space. So that was really the backdrop of then how I taught that class specifically at at days. So
that's really awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah, I liked it.
And your yoga certification.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about that. So were you taking a lot of yoga classes before?
I was. I mean, I had been doing yoga for a long time. I was a dancer before that, and so movement in that way just was really natural for me. I had been taking a lot of yoga classes and decided I would do teacher training, mostly because I was going to be able to get it for half off. So, because I was doing like a work study there too. So I had free unlimited yoga, which was amazing. And that's kind of why I decided to do it. I also like thought I was going to teach it more so than I ended up doing. I, in the past few years, decided I didn't really want to be super involved in it just because of the cultural appropriation aspect of it. Me as a white woman, I didn't feel like I should necessarily be teaching yoga. And I didn't want to take jobs away from, like, you know, Indian people who were, you know, who are here and teaching yoga, or people of color who, you know, also have yoga traditionally in their background. I didn't want to be that person. So my feelings around it have, you know, changed and evolved. I still really love yoga, but I haven't taught it in a few years, and don't intend to teach it probably ever again.
Would you teach it in a context like what you were doing at Days, or was that also before you?
I mean, that was before. Yeah. At that point, I had felt a little bit, you know, weird about it, but I also, I would potentially teach it in that way again. I don't think I would ever teach at like a traditional studio or something again. But I would do like specific trauma-informed probably. And I was doing that on a one-on-one basis for a while and had a few clients that I would see. And so I would potentially do that. But yeah, I think I'm still sort of grappling with just sort of ethically, can or should I do that? And do I want to even? And
And how did you, I was going to say come to the realization, but it sounds like it's more a process. How did you start thinking about that?
I mean, it really was more sort of an evolution of just like, you know, my feminism, I think, too. Just like when you learn more, you do better and you know... just kind of as simple as that. It wasn't like I was seeking that out, and it's not like I hadn't been personally told, like, you shouldn't do this by anybody. It didn't stem from anything like that. It really just stemmed from, I think, having created guerrilla feminism, reading more and educating myself more about cultural appropriation, what that looks like, what that is, how that makes people feel. And then also reading sort of just more historical stuff about yoga, where it's from, like what it's about and how much it's been bastardized here in the US. And that, you know, after learning about those things, I was like, oh God, I don't know if I really want to be so ingrained in this. So it was really more of a process that I'm kind of still even kind of thinking about. But I've landed in this space where I'm just like, I'm fine with not doing it not teaching it. I mean, I don't actually do it that much. I don't go to classes anymore. I do sort of just like regular stretching and things like that at home, but I'm not like, I kind of feel weird about calling it yoga necessarily, although it's hard because I do know yoga is so beneficial, and it was very healing and beneficial for me in the past. So, it's hard to reckon that, I think, mm-hmm. as and sort of figure that out as a white person and navigate, like, well, okay, can I fit in anywhere here, or is that not okay? And so still kind of evolving and thinking about all of that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere in Madison that you think does a good job?
No. A real quick answer, no. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think we have one of the worst, I think, yoga spaces, things in the, yeah, I don't know. Compared to Chicago, we really do it poorly.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of things, though. I do have a dear friend who is a yoga instructor, Kelly Fox, and she's a queer yoga instructor, and she's amazing. And, I mean, I think if I was going to take a class, I would go to her, or I would try to find a person of color, or, you know. I think there's some really cool, like, things happening with queer yoga in Madison, and, like, that's a thing, and I'm really happy about that. But otherwise, it's like, I've just had so many shitty experiences here with instructors, and then also being on this, like, being an instructor here and seeing how instructors are treated by the places they work for. And so, you know, like, that's a reality, and it's shitty. And that's too bad. And also just the overwhelming whiteness of Madison, you know, mm-hmm. and Wisconsin. But specifically Madison, you know, it's just, it's, that is a thing, right? So it's hard to find instructors, I think, who, you know, want to teach here probably and live here that are people of color. And, yeah. So I don't really have a lot of good things to say about the yoga scene here. I worked at Bliss Flow for a time when they were still around, and that was terrible. I momentarily, like, interned at Dragonfly, and that was terrible. So I used to go to Inner Fire for a while. Mm-hmm. That was terrible. That ended terribly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just don't really. And unfortunately, because yoga is such a big business now, that mm-hmm. a lot of the really smaller studios that I actually did like a Perfect Knot, they're, you know, not in business mm-hmm. anymore because they can't keep up with some of these other big places that are mm-hmm. that have like 3 or 4 locations, you know. So so yeah, I'm not super into mm-hmm. the yoga scene here. Yeah. Unfortunately. I hope it gets better someday. Yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah. And your friend who you mentioned, do they work at a studio right now?
Yeah, so she works at various studios because it's like her full-time job mm-hmm. basically. So she works at, I believe, Inner Fire, and I think their new East Side location, because they have a West Side location, a downtown location, and now an East Side location. So she's there. I think she also teaches at the studio, mm-hmm. The one on the West Side, though, I think, not the one that's kind of closer to downtown. She taught at Bliss Flow until they closed, which was just like a couple months ago. I think that's all where she's teaching now. But yeah, she's amazing. So I always tell people to go find her classes mm-hmm. if they, you know, want to go to a yoga class here. Because and I'm sure there are some other really good instructors. I just don't know them probably. But she's someone I definitely can like refer people to and be like she's trauma informed. Like she, you know, she's just a really kind, warm person. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to high school, I guess.
Okay, from there, yeah, go back to high school.
Okay, so have you been, are there other, like, groups, either on campus or actually, like, in Madison mm-hmm. that you've been involved with? So we talked about Jail Library Group.
Right.
We talked about when you worked at the RCC in days back mm-hmm. when... Mm-hmm. You did that. Are there any other campus or community things that you've been especially involved with?
I think when I was at Edgewood,
So I intern at the Campus Women's Center here because we didn't have, of course, Edgewood didn't have anything, of course. And so I remember being somewhat involved in Take Back the Night here, just not on any big scale, but I was also involved with it in Chicago, then at DePaul. I think that's the only other kind of like organization or group or thing that I've kind of been a part of while I've been here, or while I've been, in Madison. Gosh, that's a good question, though, because maybe there were more. I don't know. That's all that I can think of right now. So.
And what about other, like, career things? Because we hadn't talked about yoga at all. Is there anything else that we, like, haven't...
Any other surprises?
Anything else that you, like, was important to you for a time?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I, so when I moved back here, the only job I could get was at my old high school, at Middleton High School, as a special education assistant. And doing that work was really also very intense, but really amazing. Especially as somebody who had been in special ed back in the 90s, in that school district, being on sort of an authoritative side of that was really different. And being able to work with kids who, you know, like felt similarly to how I remember I felt, really like you feel really stupid, you feel like people think you're an idiot all the time just because you're in special ed or just because you have some sort of disability. And so it was really... I loved working with those kids and being able to be like, you're really smart, okay? Like, whatever the hell that means, but, like, you're really smart. Like, don't listen to people who say otherwise. So it was really kind of a nice mentoring thing. I felt like I was able to do that I didn't get when I was that age. And so... I mean, I often think about, like, if I wasn't going to be a librarian or, you know, something like that, I would probably want to do something with that kind of work because I really do love those students. And I think that they have to deal with so much shit that is just unbelievable and ridiculous. And it's unfortunate that it really doesn't seem to be better from where it was in the 90s when I was in special ed to how it is now. So that was a bit disheartening to, like, see that and hear about that. But, I mean, I also know that there are a lot more knowledgeable people, too, with, you know, who are kind of more able to understand disabilities and things like that and have more compassion and empathy. So so that's, you know, motivating. But yeah, I think that's the other thing that I get really just like riled up about is how those kids are treated and not just by their peers, by teachers, and you know, support staff or whoever. It's just really shitty and ridiculous to be treated like that by anybody, but by adults, it's like, what the hell are you doing? You're an adult. So yeah, I think that's the only other thing that really has kind of stuck out for me. And I think, I mean, my dad always jokes that it's like the family business because he was head of DVR, Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, for the state for a really long time and worked with a lot of very different types of people with different types of disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that's what he went to grad school for and counseling and stuff. And so I think I probably learned some of that from him, at least growing up and picked up on some of that. But and I did that work too at Anixter Center in AmeriCorps. So working again with people with disabilities, it's just always something that I've enjoyed doing and, you know, feel strongly about and feel good about. So, yeah.
And your mom was a therapist?
Yeah, so she was a therapist for 20-some years. And then, unfortunately, a client accused her of an inappropriate relationship that never happened, and he, you know, got her license removed. So she's no longer... She could have, at this point, tried to get that the license back, but she was so traumatized from the whole thing that she was like, no, I'm not doing this. So she now does spiritual guidance. She's into a lot of different new agey stuff. She does Reiki for people and kind of is a healer in her own right. And so, yeah, she's doing that still. She's 69 and my dad is going to be 72, I think. Oh my God. My parents are so old. Anyways, yeah, so.
This is maybe a little bit of a tangent, but sure. What was it like growing up with a mom who was a therapist?
So both my parents were kind of therapists because my dad did counseling, and so they both have similar master's degrees in counseling. And when they were, before the divorce, well, even after, but before the divorce, it was very much like you couldn't leave a room without talking about your feelings and like very much like, which was really great on some level and in a lot of ways, you know, but you couldn't really leave a room without like talking about like, all right, so how does this make you feel? And like, doing that whole thing. And I mean, after the divorce, it was similarly. They both were very respectful of each other and very respectful of my brother and I, and, you know, also always was, you know, wanting to have these conversations with us and ask us about our feelings and stuff. So, I mean, I blame them for why I am the way I am. So, I'm able to verbalize my feelings very well. Yeah, it was interesting to grow up with that. But I also like had an experience of going to a therapist pretty young too, at 17, and so it's like it was such a normal thing for me. Like it wasn't stigmatized like it, you know, is or was for some people, and I'm sure that's because my parents were both therapists and kind of just like, well, yeah, everyone should go to a therapist, you know, if they can, like for sure, why not? So like it was nice then too, cause that was never stigmatized. So yeah, it was an interesting way to grow up. I'll say that. Yeah.
Okay. So when you were working, in the Middleton School District, what exactly was the work that you were doing? It sounds like you were able to have some really amazing, like, mentoring.
So I was a SEA, is there what they call it, a special education assistant, and what we would do, SEAs would go into the classroom and be assigned a student who had an IEP or an individualized education plan, which is something I had when I was in school, which most students who are in special ed or who have some sort of disabilities have an IEP. It's state mandated. It's typically talks about their accommodations and what they're, you know, supposed to be allowed in classes or outside of classes, etc. So I would go into a class with a student, and it would sometimes be the same student, and I would spend like a couple classes with them. Sometimes it would be, you know, they'd have one SEA for one class and they'd have me for another class or something like that. So I would just, you know, sit with them and hang out with them in their class and be there for them specifically if they needed help with an assignment or with what was happening in the class. Some of the students were autistic and were very nonverbal, and so they sometimes it would be really hard for them to sit for a long period of time, so we would take a lot of I would, you know, take them out of the classroom sometimes if they needed to take a break, We'd go for short walks in the hallways and do things like that. One student I was assigned to, I was assigned to him because he had been suicidal. And so they were worried about him because this was for a gym class and some of the activities were like off campus, basically. And so, but he wasn't supposed to know that I was assigned to him. So it was a very kind of covert, weird kind of situation that I had not known that they did things like that before. So I was kind of presented as just like the co-teacher for the whole class, not just like I'm here for this kid. But I knew and the teacher of the class knew, like I was, you know, focusing on this one kid in case he, you know, needed something or something happened to him. But otherwise I kind of just did my own thing and just like did what the rest of the class did, which was interesting, like went bike riding and like, you know, things like that. So it was a really interesting experience. I mean, I had, you know, in the 90s, I had remembered some people who were in special ed with me had SEAs. I never had one, but I, you know, would see these like people who clearly were not students that were sitting with a student. It was interesting to kind of come full circle in some way and be like, oh, I'm now doing this for a student. It was interesting because I had thought that the other students would be like, you know, who is this person? Like, who is this other adult that's in the room? Like, that kind of sticks out, you know, like, but they were all the kids that weren't the kid I was supporting, like they all, you know, nobody really seemed to care, which was, I don't know, good or bad or whatever. They just were kind of like, whatever. Yeah. So that was nice too, because I always would kind of think, like, as the student who has that support person, like, how do you feel with that? Like, does that make you feel like everyone's looking at me and why do I have this person here, this adult here that's not the teacher? Like, but yeah, there were never really any issues. And I feel like there was way more of that back when I was in school. And so that was at least one kind of nice improvement that I saw, was like, oh, maybe like other kids and stuff are just like used to seeing SEAs with students now, and it's not like so taboo, like, oh my god, like, who is that other adult? Like, it was an interesting position. I got hit in the face a couple times by students. You know, I think, again, one of the things with that position is the administrators, the exec people don't understand how hard of a job it is. And so there's really not a lot of support for SEAs and for the work that they do. It's really, they just care if there's a body there. And that's unfortunate because there are a lot of shitty SEAs who aren't all that great with students, but, you know, they're a body, so they're there. Luckily I worked with quite a few really awesome people who seemed just, you know, they really liked working with the students as well and really, were able to be there for their students, even though the work is super hard and can be super frustrating. It was a really interesting time. And then the second year, so I worked there for like a year and a half. So the second year I was there, or second, you know, half of the year anyways, I was in sort of more with this group they have for job coaching. And so these were for students who had disabilities who were juniors and seniors at the high school. And so they were getting work experience. So we would leave the school and they, you know, some of them had like a job at like a pizza place where they were doing like they were stocking soda or something, and so we would go with them to their job and just be there for them if they needed something, but be pretty hands off. And so that's what I did then the second part of that position. So that was also really interesting, but I actually preferred going into the classes. I think so. Yeah.
And what was the training like for that position? If
there was like not much. No. That's part of the problem, I think. I mean, there was like some training, but a lot of it was kind of like, all right, like, let's go. You're doing this. So. And I think that's just kind of like part of the problem is there isn't that much training. And there needs to be, especially because if you're somebody who's never worked with a kid who's autistic or who has, or who's nonverbal and like they communicate in a different way, like if you've never done that, it could be very jarring and just like, what do, you know? So there was minimal training. Not that much though, from what I remember. It was pretty much just like, all right, great. We have another body. Like get in there, like go to this class. Like, I really learned the most from the other SEAs who had been there longer than me. So I came in and they were like, all right, so let me tell you about this student. This student like likes these things, doesn't like these things, you know, will yell and scream if these things happen, or, you know, so it was like mm-hmm. getting the rundown from other SEAs that was the most helpful. Admin, they didn't really do shit, which was again part of the problem.
Yeah.
But so training would have been nice, yeah, but and is needed for a job like that, but they don't seem to think so. And I know too that, you know, schools don't get enough funding for mm-hmm. that either, and that's also part of the problem. So it's not just, you know, admins of the schools, it's mm-hmm. of course at a statewide level. Yeah. Like, what the hell? So yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah.
It was still good, though. There were some, there were some highs and there were some lows, like mm-hmm. everything, so.
Yeah. Is there anything else you would like to say about that experience?
I don't think so. No.
Anything else you'd like to say about yoga or iSchool before we move on to my last questions?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the last thing I wanted to ask about, if you still have time today, you have had a few books published,
mm-hmm.
And I would love to hear about those. It seems like the first one was the anthology that you did about
Italian North American women. It got sort of a long title because I want so it's called Italian North American Women and the Search for Identity,
mm-hmm.
So I specifically was interested in looking at that subject matter, but I needed to, because of the it's an anthology, I needed to kind of narrow it down, so then I had to decide, okay, I'm just doing North America, because otherwise this could get really, like, really big, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
But I just put a call out and online in various spaces, and people submitted stuff, and that's really how that came to be, and then I just kind of put it together digitally. It hasn't ever been released in a physical copy, mm-hmm. but I still get questions about it, though, to this day, because do you know when that was published? I don't have the date.
I have 2013.
That sounds right.
Right?
Yep.
Okay.
And
do you remember when you started working on it?
Sometime in 2011, I think. Okay. Maybe at the end of 2010. And just decided I was going to self-publish it because it was fairly niche, and so I was like, I'm not going to try to like get a publisher for this or something. But I still get questions from people about like, where can I find it like physically? And I'm like, well, it doesn't exist physically. And they're like, can you make it into something? So I've thought about either doing like a second edition and like, mm-hmm. you know, having an actual physical copy. I don't know. I would potentially do that, but it would be works that I'd have to mm-hmm. figure out. So that's kind of still a maybe,
mm-hmm.
but so that one was the first.
And what was that process like of like putting together your first anthology? 'Cause you had worked on the literary journal.
Yeah, Edgewood. Yeah. I mean, the process was really similar to that, I guess, you know, it was like editing, like looking through what was submitted to me, editing stuff, mostly just editing for, grammar and stuff, mm-hmm. not content. And then, I mean, the hardest part was just sort of like, you know, keeping track of everybody who submitted, and like, I wasn't super organized about that, and sort of trying to then like, you know, find people to get more info, or to like, you know, get a bio from them, mm-hmm. or ask them a question about something. Like getting people to get back to me was like the most mm-hmm. difficult thing. But otherwise it was really pretty easy. I mean, I just, you know, created this thing in like a Word doc and like went from there. So yeah, it was pretty grassroots. Like that's what I did. So
and where can people find it digitally as of right now?
I think it's just on Kindle.
Okay.
You can get it on Amazon, or I think Lulu Press. It's that self-publishing platform. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just available. Because I self-published a book of poems then called Leftovers mm-hmm. in 2015, and that one is a physical thing.
Oh.
So that one, though, I made that, I think, on Lulu.com. So I don't think the other one's actually available on Lulu.com. Okay. The other one, I think, is only, it's just a digital, like, for Kindle or whatever mm-hmm. platform you have. Leftovers is a physical thing. You can order it from Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com or Lulu.com. And then, yeah.
Tell me about the process of putting together that poetry book.
Yeah, so that was after a really horrid breakup.
Mm.
And that's kind of where that came from. And it's just a bunch of short poems that I had kind of written after that experience. And that I decided, like, okay, I'm just going to put these in a thing, in a collection, because they're all, like, about the same thing. So I just decided to do that, and, decided to self-publish it, so.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
And what about, then in 2017, mm-hmm. you put together another anthology?
So I was included in it. I didn't put it together.
You were included in
right.
it.
Right. So post-traumatically yeah. stressed feminist. Mm-hmm. So I have, I believe, two poems included okay. in that. And so that was for, specifically the call for that was like, feminists who have PTSD, like, we want your work or something. And so, It's a mix of artwork and written work, poems that people submitted. So I have two poems in that.
Cool.
Yeah. So.
What is it like having what I imagine is maybe kind of personal poetry, mm-hmm. both the one that you self-published and the stuff in the anthology? What's it like having that, like, in books?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I guess I don't really care. I don't know. Like, I'm such a public person in so many ways, just because of the GF stuff, and, like, I share quite a bit of personal things, and I have shared quite a bit of personal things online for a number of years now, so it just, I don't know, for it to be in a book, it's, like, almost safer than just being out online,
okay.
Oddly enough, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't feel weird to me. Mm-hmm. It feels pretty frickin' normal.
Okay.
For better or for worse. I don't know. Well. Like, I'm kind of an oversharer, so, like, yeah. I guess it's cool to see my stuff in a
yeah.
book, in a physical book, but it also feels like, well, it wasn't, like, published by some big publishing house, so it doesn't, which I know is, like, not, whatever, like, I wouldn't think that of anyone else, but it's kind of, there is that kind of, like, like, it's not that cool. So I don't know. I mean, it's, yeah, like, when I got the first copy of, like, mm-hmm. Leftovers, I was like, oh my God, this looks really cool, and, like, I put it all together, mm-hmm. like, that's awesome, but it's just still is not the same as, like, a
book from a publisher, I guess. So, I mean, it's still cool, but yeah, I don't know. Doesn't feel any, I don't know, all that interesting or unique, especially because I think now, for people who might be listening to this in the future, I think, you know, self-publishing is like such a big thing now, and it has been for maybe the last 5-10 years. And so it's, it just is kind of feels like everyone's doing it, you know? So there's not a lot of this kind of like, ooh, like that's a, you know, unique and cool thing that you're doing, you know, or that's at least how I feel. I don't know. But self-publishing is like so much bigger now than it was but in the past. So, yeah.
And what about the anthology that you're in? Is that, was that through like a publisher?
She self-published that, Darcy McFarland. Okay. So, I mean, and she's really cool. I met her in person once, and you know, she does a lot of great work and has put together a couple different anthologies, but yeah, it's self-published. So.
So it kind of just feels about the same as having stuff on the internet.
Yeah.
Not, like, cooler or more empowering and also not weirder.
No, yeah. It's just kind of like, I mean, I don't want to sound like an asshole or, like, ungrateful.
No.
But, like, but it's just, you know, like, so, I mean, I'm working on another book, and that, about guerrilla feminism specifically, and that, I feel like, if it ever comes to the point of getting published, will feel differently because I do have a literary agent and I, you know, they would be the ones to sell it to a publisher. So if and when that happens, that I think will feel differently to me. Should it feel differently? Probably not. Cause I mean, I would say to anybody like, no, like you're, that's awesome that you published it regardless. Right. But of course I, you know, am human and can't get that kind of out of my head of like, well, you just self-published it, whatever. So, but I think, I mean, I can imagine that it would feel a little different to me if and when this next book actually finds a publisher. So,
are you allowed to talk about
the upcoming book then? Yeah, so it's tentatively titled Guerrilla Feminism. God, what is the... Do you have it there?
I have Guerrilla Feminism : Essays.
So, Essays on Digital Trauma. Okay. Is what it's is what's after the colon right now. See, I haven't looked at it in a while because it's like sitting at my lit agent's desk and I haven't heard back from her yet, so I'm just kind of like not looking at it until she gets back to me. But yeah, it's going to be a collection of essays about different facets of guerrilla feminism and the work that I've done. So, but will be somewhat memoir-ish as well. So, I initially was gonna do this kind of like toolkit idea of like activism online, but I just really couldn't get anywhere with that and didn't feel like I really, there are so many books like that now too, that I just was kind of like, eh. And my heart was just not in it. So I was like, I can't really write from a place that my heart's not in.
Yeah.
So, I talked with my lit agent and she also suggested like, well, why don't you like do something that's more personal? And so I was like, sure, why not? Like, so I'm still working on that and sort of deciding. I mean, I've only really started the proposal process. So what would happen is I would finish the proposal, you know, that would go to my lit agent and they would, you know, edit it and whatever. And then she would try to talk it up and see what publishers would be interested. So that's how that would happen. So we shall see. Hopefully, I'm hoping to at least get the proposal done within this year, because it just needs to be done with at this point.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see.
And how did the agent find you, or did you find her, or how did that happen?
So kind of, I mean, kind of both. I mean, I got the agent very easily because of my presence online and because of guerrilla feminism. So, I mean, I'm not going to say it was anything else. It was really because of that and because I have a following. Because, of course, that's one of the things, like it or not, that they look at, because like they're like thinking about sales, like could this person write a book that sells to people? So yeah, because I have a following, of course she was like, yeah, all right, let's work together. So yeah, so we kind of found each other that way. She had another client that had been following my account and had mentioned me to her, I think, is what happened. And so then she contacted me and was like, hey, I heard you might be interested in a lit agent. And so we went from there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you think that's the case with like anyone who has a following online? Because like you have done a lot of writing.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I don't want to sell myself short, but I also think that in this day and age, because social media and numbers matter so much, I think that, I think it is it's easier for somebody in my situation than someone who's not. Because I've heard from people how hard it is to get a lit agent. Especially if you're just cold calling, cold emailing people, just like sending your work to and trying to get somebody, that's hard. So if you have some sort of presence where people can kind of check you out, you know, and like in their own time and see what you're about, and if you're, you know, verified and you have that little blue check mark on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, I think that makes somebody feel like they can take more of a chance on you. Again, whether that's good or bad. So I think anyone who's in my situation could easily get a lit agent. It doesn't mean you have a book deal, that's different, right. But like, you know, can get a lit agent. Yeah.
It still sounds exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited about it. Yeah. So
is there anything else that you would like to say about any of those projects or any other projects that you've like sort of had in mind for the future?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty much everything. Okay. Yeah.
Anything else that you would like to have on the record about any of the things we've talked about?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I just hope that, like, I go down in history for some cool stuff, some cool feminist stuff. 'Cause I've felt for a long time that, especially here in my hometown, in my home state, I'm very undervalued. It seems like people like my work and like what I do and seem to value me outside of Wisconsin, but it seems very much when it comes to Madison, when it comes to Wisconsin, not a lot of people seem to care. So when I think about like my legacy or things like that, it's like I hope that Wisconsin can feel good about the fact that I was born and raised here and have lived here. So,
well, yeah. I hope so too. I hope Wisconsin wakes up to you.
Thank you. Me too. That's all.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to turn this off now.
Sure.